Welcome back to Next Stop. This is your special takeover of the TTT podcast, Talking Transport Transformation, brought to you by TUMI, the Transformative Urban Mobility Initiative. I'm your host, Sana Khasawne, the Ambassador on Inclusion and Sustainable Transport. Today, our ride takes us to Cairo, a city of 20 million people, where history, mobility, innovation, and resilience all collide. And what makes it special is that I have two guests with me today. Please join me in welcoming my guests for today, Hamad Higazi and Ghada Abdelaziz. Higazi is the co-founder of Transport for Cairo. He's also the transport lead for the Climate Champions. His experience spans over a decade across Africa and the global stage. He's an enthusiastic cyclist and he's an avid reader. While Ghada Abdelaziz is a senior research associate at Transport for Cairo, her background is in architecture and public policy. If you ask her about her favorite thing in the world, she will say the blue tram of her home city, Alexandria. Higazi and Ghada, welcome to Next Stop.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Sana, good to see you.
Thank you so much for joining. Basically, at Next Stop, we have a dynamic conversation with our guests and we make multiple stops. So my first stop is going to be with you, Higazi, around young people and transportation. There has been recently a report by the International Transport Forum about young people and transport in the 21st century. And this report highlights that the young generation today is less likely to pursue a career in transportation. You are a leader of a team of 10 young professionals. So what do you think are the opportunities that we can offer to the young generation in order to make this sector more dynamic and more attractive for them? Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your own experience as a young person, and then I can ask you more about the experience of Transport for Cairo as a young consultancy firm.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I'm not really familiar with that particular report. But when we talk about people working in transport, we need to distinguish very clearly between professionals who are working on the management of the systems, the operations, the design, the planning, which is what we do. We are transport planners who work at the very early stage in the conception of projects, identification of issues, design of solutions to address them. This is very different from the majority of workers in the transport space, which includes drivers, workers, conductors, people in the logistics space, particularly in not just urban bus systems and metro systems, but also in the freight space. And there is definitely an issue with the attractiveness of the job for workers, primarily as a function of the long hours and the difficulty of the job. It is a very difficult job. And also the pay that is provided that historically has been getting diminished. And this sector is about to touch upon a big amount of disruption with the advent of autonomy and autonomous driving. And actually, one of the biggest use cases for autonomous driving is going to be on the really long stretches of highways in the Midwest, in the US, in China, which is already happening, in Saudi Arabia, between cities and like hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of desert roads. So it's not necessarily what you think about an autonomous car driving in a city. It is taking the burden of the drivers from these very monotone sections of driving. Now, when you come to the professional space and what we do, our particular niche of transport planners, well, believe it or not, but I actually never took a formal transport class in my life. The only one I was offered one, I joined the first class and I politely excused myself to take another course on public policy. And I think that this is really the beauty of transport and public transport in particular. It's not about the traffic engineering or the civil works only. It really is a multidisciplinary space. It is a cross-sectoral, cross-dimensional sector that touches upon so many different items and dimensions. And it's only then that we can really excel in the development and supply of good transport services. Let me give you an example. If you look at France, a big portion of public transport financing comes from the Ministry of Education. because they use the public transport system as their school bus system. In other societies, health funding is increasingly being used to fund interventions that improve air quality because it's a much better bang for the buck, return on the dollar, than investing in more hospitals to treat people that are sickened by air pollution. And it is exactly in this cross-sectorality that you see transport as a very attractive space for all kinds of disciplines beyond studying transport. So you can enter at any point in your career, you can enter with various different backgrounds in your career. Fundamentally, transport is easy to understand and easy to start building a big, deep understanding of the sector to provide value in it.
Actually, throughout the report, they highlight the different mobility patterns and behaviors of young people in the transport system. And they find that the main concern for the youth generation today is related to affording transportation. Many people across like Africa or maybe Latin America, like low middle income countries, they struggle to afford transportation. And this takes away a lot of opportunities for them to access education, to access opportunities. So do you think that there is a gap of awareness about understanding how transportation impacts our lives? And how can we overcome this gap? Do you think that providing incentives to youth to join this sector would do the job? Do you think that providing maybe decent wages and basically human working conditions for them would make this field like more dynamic and more attractive?
Well, it's not just about how the transport system affects affordability. It's fundamentally about how the city affects the ability to use, regardless of which transport system is there. If you look at a city like Cairo, the old core is very, very dense. So it is physically easy to walk the distances that are required to reach probably everything that you need. Now, that there are other challenges in the short term, such as a lot of cars taking a lot of parking space, making it hard to navigate the streets, the predominance of cars and vehicular traffic on the roads, and the negative externalities of the pollution and the sound, and potentially the difficulty of crossing and intersections. These are the things that make walking more difficult. But if you look at the parts of our cities that were really built in the last 25 and 50 years, these are the parts that are more sprawling over much bigger and longer distances, because they are a function of the availability of motorized transport, and thus it stops becoming an option to be able to just walk around everywhere, and reliance on a system and its affordability starts to become really important. And I think that your city, Alexandria, is a case study, because Alexandria is one of those cities with natural borders. So it really grew upwards to become much more dense than sprawling. So how would you answer that, Reda?
I mean, when I look back at Alexandria, you would see that the mobility pattern is definitely different, especially with the spine. We have like some sort of a spinal system. You have the main Corniche road parallel to it as a tram, and then you have the borders, like you're saying, at the somehow hugging the city, let's say. So it's quite different when you notice the expansion and affecting the effect of transportation on also the building patterns. So like what you're saying is we're more inclined to build higher buildings compared to Cairo, which is expanding horizontally rather than vertically. But then again, transportation plays a big part of it because it shapes how compact the city is. So in the case of Alexandria, they're trying to create these new extensions of the city, but this is why maybe there's more effort to have more quicker kinds of modes of transport to connect these new establishments, new spaces extended to Alexandria to pull the people back and forth somehow, a miniature of Cairo, but hopefully not as extended as Cairo.
I love how you covered like so many aspects to how young people, you know, perceive transportation as a sector, and also through like their daily commutes on the road and how that's connected with financing, with climate, with health. But my next stop is going to be with you, Ghada, to focus mainly on education and training. Higazi mentioned something like really important. When we talk about transportation, we don't only need engineers to have transportations. We don't only need planners and architects. We also need data scientists. We need communicators. We need people who are knowledgeable of public policies and governance. So education alone is not enough. And if I want to ask you about how can we like strengthen the capacity building that comes after education or that complements education, and maybe we can investigate together the need to provide meaningful opportunities for young people, like internships or maybe mentorship programs, so that what they study in the classrooms is actually translated into job opportunities or into career paths in sustainable transport.
Well, the point is, actually, when you ask most of the people who I've met working in transport, most probably they're not transport engineers. So they're coming from other sectors, like you and myself and you also. We are architects and somehow found our way here in transport. So you are thinking about two aspects. You're thinking about future workforce, and this is where education plays a big part. And you're thinking about current workforce, which is where capacity building can play also a bigger part. So when you're thinking about youth who might be interested in the future working in transport, you have to think about how the design of curricula currently and the design of transport inclusion. In one of our studies, which is actually done with the support of TUMI, we were trying to differentiate between functional and technical capacities. So technical capacities is, you know, transport engineering, data analysis, understanding demand. But then you also have this functional part, which is related to contracting, procurement, budgeting, and also climate aspects. So you have to distinguish that people who should be working in transport should not just be transport engineers. They should expand more than that, because it's about humans, about their accessibility to services. It's about how noticing the differences in patterns between women, mothers, and people with needs in their mobility patterns. So looking back at education in this specific study with TUMI, we found out that one of the biggest gaps is in how much is sustainability tackled in educational programs. And there is a big gap there, because current workforce are having to deal with these new systems. You have the bus rapid transit, you have the metro, you have these extensions, you have walkability also coming into the equation. At the same time, they're quite used to the expand the road solution. So there's this big gap between what they know and what they're used to and their day-to-day processes and what they have to accommodate themselves to the new systems. So maybe rethinking about the design of curricula and rethinking about the methodologies of teaching, so that you can show students, urban planners, architects, economists, sociologists, anthropologists, it's not just about, you know, technical sciences, but also about the social sciences and its part in understanding communities and their mobility.
This is really wonderful to hear, and maybe I can also share my experience, how I got also in transportation. I lived most of my life in Irbid, which is like a small city in North Jordan, and whenever I had to work in Amman or to go see some friends, I drove there because I didn't like to use public transportation because it's unreliable, maybe uncomfortable, and I was honestly like a little bit concerned about harassment and other issues. So basically, whenever I go to Amman, I rely on Google Maps. I cannot navigate in, like, the capital of my own country because I never walked there. I realized that when I moved to Beirut to do my master's degree, and as a student, I mostly commuted walking. And I can draw a map of Beirut now, like on top of my head, easily. And I can maybe tell you how to get from one place to another, although I lived there for like a year and a half. But the capital of my own country, I do struggle to navigate because I do not walk. And this actually opened my eyes that you cannot build a connection with the city where you live, with the city where you come from, if you don't walk there. You need to like see the buildings, you need to go in the streets, you need to see the people. And cars take this away from us. And this is why I was really interested to learn more about, you know, how Amman became like that. Why did we design it to accommodate cars only? Why don't we have, you know, like an adequate transport system? Why don't we offer like other modes of travel to people? So maybe You can tell me a little bit about your experience in Cairo or moving from Alexandria to Cairo and how that shaped your perception about transport and what are the things that you would like to change working in the field now?
I mean, it's an intense change between Alexandria and Cairo. It's quite a drastic change for me, especially that, like you're saying, I'm a very walking kind of person. So in Alexandria, I walk to the tram, I use the tram, and another time I use the microbuses. I don't drive and I can't drive, so I do depend on walking as much as possible. And then you have this connection with the city, which is quite different and intimate, like you're saying, and you have an identity for the city as well. In Cairo, I would sense that in more of the inner city parts. So I have a sense of connection with the older Cairo, with the historic part of Cairo. But then again, in newer parts of Cairo, I might struggle a bit with creating this connection because, like you're explaining, it might be related to being able to walk there, being able to create a connection there and seeing parts of the city. You can just remind yourself that, you know, this is the place where I'm used to getting my groceries from. This is the guy who I buy the flowers from, whatever your system is. So this navigational kind of aspect I might be struggling with. But in terms of solutions to it, I think maybe reshaping let's say the transit spaces, because eventually we are creating these kind of transport hubs. And accessing these transport hubs might be a good beginning, because once you know that you can access, let's say, the metro in 15 minutes walking in a shaded area, I'm sure that a lot of people would depend on accessing the metro itself. So maybe these, you know, first and last mile solutions we might put more investment into it, see how it can relate to improving ridership, improving accessing the systems itself, maybe pulling the strings a bit on how wide the city is in Cairo. Maybe as a person who's biking, it's quite different as well.
No, absolutely. I bike in every city where I go live, including here in Cairo. And it's a beautiful experience because you get to really see the streets. You get to, normally when I cycle, I take side streets. So it's a very different experience than driving. And then you get to see the beautiful things. Like here in Cairo, you have the celebrationally papers that they put for, you know, for Ramadan, or like the Fawanis Ramadan, the lanterns and all of these tiny details and the smells, the good and the bad, and the dogs that run after me, you know, it's definitely an alive experience, but you get to know the city. And particularly when you travel a lot and you spend time in other cities, that's really how you get to know the city.
It's true.
Absolutely. I can share something from Amman. Actually, yesterday, the Greater Municipality of Amman opened a project, which is basically walking and cycling lanes for people. And they framed it as a public sports space for the community. And that the main motive for this project was to support people to be more physically active in order to address like many health concerns that are, you know, like increasing in our society, like obesity and all the associated health risks. So maybe if you ever come to Amman, I'd love to take you to explore this space.
No, but this stuff matters, you know, like one time I was in a professional meeting and I literally joked, and it's a true fact, that people who spend more than an hour commuting a day are much more likely to get divorced and end up fat. And this comment, you know, like it resonated with people because people are sometimes stuck in long commutes and they know the price that is to be paid by it. And it actually led to me getting a job from that. And I think that this is one of the really beautiful things about transport, is that it's such a lived experience and such a shared experience. Like the transport sector is actually quite similar to the energy sector. But the difference is that energy is segregated in a power plant, in a field, in a solar power plant, somewhere walled off away. Whereas transport is something that we use every day. We are the electrons that move through the pipelines. So that's why it's much more complex. And it's really about the user experience and the time. And this is the beauty and the challenge of the space. The challenge because people believe that they understand it, whereas intuitively they do as users. But the moment you start thinking about it from a planning and organizing perspective, things change completely. And then you get to see a dynamic like cities where people walk because they use public transport and there is a high modal share of active travel and public transport use, they tend to be healthier. People tend to live longer lives with a lot more healthy years than in cities where people are captive to their cars. And that's what policymakers have really started to wake up to now. And that's why we are seeing these projects and these kind of changes in our cities.
Exactly. And to build on what you said, I attended a talk a couple of weeks ago by a Jordanian medical doctor, Adam Bataine, and it was around biohacking. So he was saying like a lot of things that people need to be mindful of in order to like remain physically healthy and young so that you can be, you know, like in a good shape even if you get older. So if you want to be like in your 25 years old body at 70, there are a couple of things that you need to consider. And the main thing was walking. So I asked him, for someone that lives in a country like Jordan, where the cities are very car centric, how can I walk 10K steps a day? There is no space for me to do that. So my solution is to have like a gym membership and to walk those steps on a treadmill. But I also realized that there are a lot of health risks that come with this. Being exposed, for example, to AC for long hours and also not having like a horizon, like not having something to look to. You're just facing a wall basically, or maybe a window. And this has an impact on mental health and on the health of eyesight and so many things. So truly, like, transportation impacts our health in a way that maybe we don't see like at the surface. Like, you, it's really like has so many impacts if we like think about it. But I want to move to another stop with you, Higazi, about transport for Cairo. So from what I've read on the internet, you started as a data mapping initiative. You wanted to basically create a visual map for informal transportation in Cairo. And now you have a consultancy firm with over 70 implemented projects across Africa and Asia. Can you please tell us the story of Transport for Cairo? What motivated you to start this? And what is keeping you going?
Oh, absolutely. So it was actually a project that took place in Nairobi, Kenya, that provided the original inspiration. And the project was called Digital Matatus. And they mapped the matatus, which are the local public transport system. And these are informal buses that combined provide this organic system that's actually almost formal in how organized it is. People use it to go to work every day. And this really resonated because you could see that transport is one of those things that affects health outcomes, that affects educational outcomes, that affects developmental outcomes. And if you are impact minded, and we had asked ourselves the question, what is the single thing that we can do that can achieve the biggest amount of change with the minimum amount of resources that we have to get started? Mm-hmm. And this project was like a light bulb. So we decided to give it a go and to try to do it in Cairo, immediately realizing that Cairo is a very challenging city, because we have many more modes of transport. We have a metro system, we had a tram system, we have a formal bus system, we have a microbus system, a minibus system, and all of them work together as a single organic whole and they're invisible. So it was really about making this invisible system visible, enabling Journey Planner for people to know how to travel from A to B. And as you mentioned, a lot of the people that come into a city are actually people from outside. You know, like, there's this very, very interesting statistic that I love about Paris, that 90% of the individuals who take the Paris commuter rail take it for the first time ever. Now, it's not 90% of the people, because most people take it every day. They don't need that information. But if you actually look at the individuals, you have so many tourists and so many visitors and so many French people who need to get errands run, that the people who use the system every day are actually just 10% of the names that use it. And this really resonated with me because it shows how important information is. Mm-hmm. We got really good at creating this information. So we created it for Cairo, put it on Google Maps, and started using it for planning, and started doing that for other cities. And this is how today we became the professional consultancy that we are, providing capacity, building in the field, having our own software tool that really optimize this process of collecting this data to the highest quality at the lowest cost with the lowest risk, and continue to be able to do so across many, many different other cities. And it's a really important thing, because reality is that it's like almost that two-thirds of the built environment that will be there by 2050 hasn't been built yet. You need to really take a moment to let that statistic sink in. It's almost scary. So this is like maybe 5 or 7 years old, but we're almost there to 2050, you know? And it just shows the how fast our cities are growing and how big the population growth is going to be in Africa. This is demographics. It's going to happen. And how will it happen? Well, there is a particular development pattern, and it's not very healthy. And it's been well documented in some reports. It's like flat and it's organic and it is sprawling and it's too fast for planners to keep up to. And this is why understanding how transport evolves to keep up with this and maybe doing the right intervention, because transport directly affects how the urban environment looks like. It is like the yin and yang. It's a marriage. They both come together. This is what we're working on. It's one of the most impactful interventions that we can do on how we will live in the future, how much energy we will be dependent on consuming, what's the impact going to be on climate change, but also how it is going to adapt to climate change. Because in the heating world that we're living in, relying on walking throughout all hours of the day, throughout all societies, is actually quite difficult, and at some points becoming not really possible anymore. We live in a different world than the one that our grandparents lived in.
Absolutely. And there is like this paradox in the work that you are doing, which basically is balancing business with the social mission that you are trying to address, you know, like providing transportation services that respond to people's needs, but with minimum resources and doing the right things and also like making profit. Ghada, you are also part of the Transport for Cairo team, and you are also a part of a minority, which is women working in transportation. We always talk about the challenges and the barriers that women face in this field. But this time, I want to ask you about the opportunities, especially at the policy level. How can we make the industry better for women at the policy level? And also, how can we make sure that women who get into this field are actually integrated in the design and planning so that they can also reflect the unique needs of women as everyday transport users?
Reflecting back at something that we were discussing in the beginning, it's not an industry or just a field. There's public authorities, there's private sector, there's the final end user. So I think that women, I would say, needs would vary across according to their position in it. So maybe not just, I don't think we're, I'm not very also comfortable with a minority, because I know the field is very different according to where you're standing at. So now I remember a meeting we had with an authority, a transport authority here in Cairo, and I would say like 80% of the room were women. And we were, and they were working across departments. But then again, is that the indicator of just having women in the room, is that enough? Because again, this is a public authority. It provides kind of benefits that work for the needs of women. But again, in private industries, are women finding the needs that they have, or is it too competitive? Does it not accommodate their needs? And they're like, this is more about a public-private kind of argument, because women might not be finding the benefits that they need in the private sector. So this is not just about transport. It's about the private sector. What might make things more comfortable, I think, would be not to put women into a big case and just look at them as a hollow one kind of group. You have women who are mothers, you have women who work in public authorities, you have women who work in leadership positions, and you have women who want to use a system that is comfortable, and the needs for each is different. So maybe it's not about being minor in a group, but rather giving enough, I would say, agency for women to speak up if they feel that the system is not working. So maybe I feel like I've just opened windows without giving solutions, but I think one of the biggest solutions would be not to look at women as just a whole, but rather as these different kind of groups.
This is really interesting. Women are not a homogeneous group. They have different needs and they have different challenges based on where they are. And actually, in Jordan, transportation is the biggest obstacle and the biggest barrier for women to access jobs at all. Like a lot of women, based on in a recent study, they reject job opportunities because of the high cost of transportation. So I think that the issue has multiple dimensions, and it wouldn't be smart to look just at one angle. So I do really appreciate the perspective that you have brought. The following stop is with Higazi around the new decade on sustainable transport that is approaching within a few weeks. And I've heard a lot about governments being in debt and struggling to finance transportation. And we have learned that loans are not necessarily the answer, but at the same time, transport are capital intensive. How do you see this decade as an opportunity to resolve this paradox, especially that it's calling for investments in sustainable transport? And by principle, this means maybe public transportation, active mobility, and this is mainly about infrastructure. So how do we resolve this paradox?
Well, I think that sometimes the best way to look at the future is really to look at the past. And the answer to this is to look, where was the transport space 10 or 15 years ago? And if you look at the climate negotiations, for instance, transport wasn't there. Transport had historically been a subset of energy, because energy is measured and transport is an energy user. It's a service that uses energy, and it has been classified as such. And it's really the pioneering work that took place 15 years ago that led to the founding of Slowcat and the intellectual framework behind avoid, shift, improve, how do I travel less? How do I get people to use public transport? How do I travel more cleanly? And this is really progressing now with the electrification. Okay. This pioneering work has led to transport being now in every climate conference, having the community well organized in the partnership, having a clear call for how transport should shape, that led up to the creation of this sustainable decade. So there's been massive amount of change over the last 15 years. And I think that the next 10 years are likely going to be a continuation of this trajectory. What I mentioned earlier, this cross-sectionality and this realization in some of the most sophisticated, public policy settings that we have, where public transport infrastructure is not financed on its own. It is financed through the health budget, through the education budget, through these different mechanisms, because it makes sense, because it is about value that is created through having a good transport system that is not directly captured by the provider of the system. And actually, all of the great cities of this world, you're talking about the New York, you're talking about Paris and London, the heads of empire, but also Istanbul and Beijing and Tokyo, they are based on the availability of great transport systems. Companies and people, they pay extra to live in these expensive hubs because the transport systems allow them to access a lot more opportunities and options. So it's really these dynamics that provide, the supporting wind, the draft that allows transport systems to be built and financed. So I see a lot of change in public policy in that. I think there is already a change happening in how policymakers and decision makers look at the system and how they create structures to be able to capture that value that is created. If you want to get very technical, it's something like land value capture. You make a public transport system, you build real estate next to it, the real estate gets more expensive and you capture it. If you look at, a mafia series or something, you see the dons talking about it. Now, this is the extreme example, but some societies are able to capture that using public policy. And this is really expanding. And we're even seeing it here in very different forms. So I'm very optimistic about it. And actually, transport pays back, you know? And this is why investments in the sector have been increasing and they continue increasing. And I think that the real challenge and the real item, you know, that we want to be tackling head on is how do we use the limited resources that we have to the best way possible? And this is one of the reasons why we've been working with popular informal transport, because these are systems that are entirely self-financed. They bring their own capital, they cover their own operational costs. Sometimes they take advantage of some subsidies that are provided to everybody else, so they don't get any kind of special treatment, and they're functioning. And this is kind of magical. And it's not necessarily good because there are a lot of problems that are associated with them. But it means that if you can harness this energy in the correct way, and you have seen some first examples from South Africa and other societies, you can really thrive. And this is still an intellectual challenge to tackle. How do you design these interventions to really leverage this dynamic? But there is a very great people, there are great funders, you know, the VIRA Foundation working on that, that are pushing the boundaries of what's possible. And that's why I'm very optimistic about this next decade.
Mm-hmm. That's really powerful, Higazi. And I also share your enthusiasm. I think with the Sustainable Development Agenda, transportation was not like directly prioritized. We did not have an SDG for transport, but transport was like scattered across multiple SDGs. So maybe the opportunity with this new decade is to reframe transportation as climate, as equality, jobs, and also health priority. So to bring this intersection where like different sectors and different agents can work together in order to achieve not only better transport, but also health, climate, and equity targets. And when we talk about sustainable transport, we need to talk about active mobility in particular. And maybe I can ask Ghada about walkability, because you are certainly excited about walkability. Actually, I have been to Cairo many times, and to me, like it's a city that offers you like this chaos, but it's a nice chaos. Like you enjoy it, so you can like at one point take the metro, then you can take maybe a tuk-tuk, and you can walk anywhere. I saw people walking even on the highways. It's dangerous. Please don't do it. But I mean, like there are like the mobility situation like has a lot to offer. So there is this richness in the behavioral and the patterns of people. But I want to ask you about how you perceive the walking reality in Cairo, and what are the existing opportunities in order to make it more walkable, especially in light of the recent infrastructure projects, you know, that maybe prioritize highways over active travel and active modes of travel.
And maybe I'll start with a keyword that you mentioned, which is perceive. So a lot about walking is about perception. And this is an important remark, because sometimes people would be captive to thinking about walking as just infrastructure. So if you have a sidewalk and you have a tree, then this space should be walkable. But this isn't necessarily true. So maybe from our research, we've tried the two approaches to understanding walkability. We have this approach of auditing streets, counting trees, measuring sidewalks, seeing how connected a network is in terms of sidewalks and so on, intersections, and if there is a stop or is there some sort of traffic arrangement. So we looked at the infrastructure. But then again, in another project, we were assessing the perception, like you're saying. And this was with the support of the walkability app by Walk21. And at the perception level, you get to ask people more of how comfortable are you? How uncomfortable? Are you feeling safe? Are you feeling secure? Mm-hmm. You ask these series of questions, the infrastructure matters, but then it shows you new insights. It tells you that some spaces, such as, you know, new and new kind of communities that are being built, You might have the sidewalk, you might have the infrastructure, but you don't necessarily feel comfortable. Because maybe the sun, as you were saying, the sun, you know, along the strip, you would walk like for maybe 20 minutes in a strip sidewalk, and you see the highways on the left. But yes, this is a sidewalk, but how comfortable am I using it? So looking at walkability I'm not sure in Cairo or in Egypt as a wider lens, I think it's maybe pushing a bit the boundary of not just building it, because building it is not the final answer. You have to make sure that the perception of the user is comfortable enough, secure enough. Sometimes if I have a sidewalk but I don't have lighting, I definitely would not feel safe using that kind of system. So walkability in Cairo, I think it can be a struggle when we're planning new cities, because you still want to make sure that people can feel comfortable walking this kind of length. But also in the inner city, you need to make sure that people are not suffocating from all of the, I would say, changing air quality. Maybe I'll stop here and question how much about the solutions. And now I remember that. I think we have to start with the transit catchment areas. Like if we're building something new, or we have a new system coming up, we need to make sure that people can actually reach there. And we have extensions of new lines and we have extensions of services. Maybe start with a 15 meter catchment area, make sure people are comfortable enough using that, and then expand this circle one bit by another after the other.
15 meters?
500 meters.
500 meters.
Did I say 15 meters?
You said 15 meters.
That's not possible.
But you know what? Like, if you allow
me
to build
on that, 1 kilometer.
You can actually extend it to 1 kilometer and 1.5 kilometers by also integrating micromobility. And this is a big game changer. Like electric scooters, I really do not like them. I cannot use them, but they are effective. And you see more and more people. Like I just came back from Dubai, for instance, which is one of the most car-centric cities there is, but it does mm-hmm. have a public transport system. Yes. It does have a very difficult weather system. Mm-hmm. And you cannot find a parking spot for your bicycle at the metro stop because there are so many. Mm-hmm. You can see everywhere across classes, people using electric micromobility scooters mm-hmm. to move to the public transport system. So they are expanding the catchment areas. And if you look at other cities, you know, like Paris is a famous example. They moved away from this half meter cycle lane to cycle lanes that are a meter and a half, that are essentially car lanes, one in each direction, just completely the right of way taken away from the cars and moved to active mobility. And there are traffic jams. Riding a bicycle is not a pleasant experience, but it's a very functional experience. It's definitely much more pleasant and faster than taking the car because so many people are actually using them. And this is an absolute paradigm shift. And I think that the electrification of like small vehicles, there has been also an ITF study on that, is a complete game changer. And I want to point out an item because I really think it's important to keep in mind. Markets affect things very, very strongly. And one of the most interesting statistics, you know, Ben McKibben, he wrote an article about it a couple of weeks ago for Climate Week New York in the Times. If you look at a society like Pakistan, they have blackouts. They increased from 23 to 24 their imports of solar panels by like 5x. Mm. And in another year, again by 3x. It's massive amounts of solar that's coming in that they're almost creating in a distributed level more electricity than the grid can provide. And this is immediate. This is between 2 years because the prices are so low. The crisis of the grid stability is high and people react to that. Now, this kind of change is slowly happening also in the electrification of transport, and you're starting to see explosive growth in the electrification of vehicles, be them small vans, motorcycles, tricycles, also for delivery, but also cars. And some of the fastest growing adopters of e-vehicles are Southeast Asian countries that are building their local, you know, like the biggest supplier in Vietnam is a local company, and China with their new energy vehicles are in a league of their own. And this change, you know, coupled with the availability of cheap electricity and the ability to produce even more cheap electricity with solar power, this is a complete mind changer. And it's the same with micromobility. And once you start bringing in these different dynamics and link them to transit, you can finally see how public transport systems that exist today can be made to really reach their full potential. Because in a lot of Global South societies, we are seeing extensive investments in metro systems and in rail systems that are not really reaching their potential yet, because we need to figure that out, because we need to work on the payment systems, on the passenger information. And there are many, many dynamics, like the availability of cheap electricity to solar, but also the availability of micromobility and the electrified version of it, that are complete game changers. So I am really, really excited about this, and how policymakers can use something as simple as right of way. This road is now dedicated for public transport, dedicated for active mobility. Play with paint on the roads and enforce them and make things happen.
Yes, exactly. We have the BRT system that is basically connecting like some parts within the capital, but the existing lane right now is only part of a bigger network that the Greater Municipality of Amman is investing in. And I can see that they are also including in the vision of Amman for 2030, a lot of micro-mobility alternatives for people in order to replace cars. The issue with the BRT right now is, for example, if I want to take a bus, I cannot find a space to park my car, because when they built the bus stations, there were no parking lots available to accommodate the big numbers of cars for people. So the only solution is to basically take a car, like ride sharing, in order to reach the station, and then you can take the bus. But it's been really so far a great solution and budget friendly for university students, because there are like many colleges and many universities at the root of the BRT. So far, youth have been like the biggest the people that have gained the most benefits from this project.
I absolutely love that, because when we do transport planning, we often treat people as if they're interchangeable. But actually, when you start working with people from a young age that they're habituated to use public transport, perceptions and use cases completely change, and people design their lives around it. And this is proven, you know, this is why in a lot of Western societies, especially in big cities like New York, you're seeing the newer generation, you know, forgive me for using Gen Z, but they're not making driver license anymore, because they designed their life about having a bicycle, having micromobility, needing a car, they can rent it for a day, you know, by an hour, by a day, by an Uber, and they can get all of their mobility needs without having to do the big investment into cars. So really getting people to adopt these new lifestyles from young on is a complete game changer.
I think the first time I felt like an adult was when my parents told me you can get to ride the tram on your own, and I felt like this is it, I'm an adult.
Actually, maybe Gen Z of Europe do not care about getting a driver's license, but Gen Z in Jordan still want to like brag and get their own cars, because it's still perceived as, you know, freedom. It's the mode of mobility that gives you the freedom, and you also can show off in front of your friends. So I think there is a cultural problem here about how we perceive transportation, because public transport maybe in Jordan is perceived as something maybe low class, or people for like poor people or those who cannot afford cars. And this is not certainly true. I've been really enjoying this conversation, but we have reached our final stop. So I wanted to ask both of you, Higazi and Ghada, about your own next stops as individuals, or maybe as representatives of Transport for Cairo.
Maybe I'll start off, because we were just talking about the BRT. We are currently working on a capacity building program for the Land Transport Regulatory Authority here in Cairo, trying to support them in their new role as a regulator for a new service such as the BRT. And I think a lot of the challenge here is back to what we were discussing about workforce planning and seeing this future workforce, and also addressing the needs and the gaps in the current workforce. So a lot of the work that I'm being involved in transport is related to capacity development and maybe designing programs that can actually support institutions who are out there doing their jobs but need the support to maybe push a bit further to making sure that the system is finding its final results, the one they're planning for.
Mm-hmm. And for me, my next stops are really going to be the COP30 in Belém. This is going to be upcoming very soon, and it will be followed by World Transport Day and then the beginning of the UN Decade of Sustainable Transport. So there's plenty of change happening. I'm really honored to be able to work with a big part of the community. And there is a very big, thriving, well-connected, collaborating transport community working across the different modes and across the different geographies. And they're just cool people, you know, like maybe the best thing to sell people about coming and investing in a professional career in the transport spaces, you will be surrounded by just fun people. And that's it.
This is amazing. Actually, in Arabic, we say la yumal. I really cannot get enough of this conversation. So thank you so much, Higazi and Ghada, for all the amazing insights that you have brought into this conversation. I was really honored to have you with me on this episode. We're going to add a lot of links in the description box where you can check the projects of Transport for Cairo and also the latest blog posts from Tumi. Until next time, see you.